Hi everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Media Voices, bringing you the news and the views from around the media world. I'm your host, Chris Sutcliffe.
I'm Esther Thorpe.
And I'm Peter Houston.
Esther, who did you interview this week?
So this week I spoke to Claire Sanderson. She's the Editor-in-Chief of Women's Health UK. We discussed their growing circulation. Yes, you've heard that right, their circulation is growing. We talked about how they, why they love working with influencers and how mental health has become such a vital part of overall wellness.
Sounds amazing, but before we get into that, we just want to remind you all that we are actually writing a report. We're going to be at a launch event in London on the 13th of November. There is an RSVP link in the newsletter. Please come and help celebrate.
Ooh, yeah. I think there might be like a free pizza in it or something as well.
I have heard
and
that.
Free beer.
Yeah. I'll take it. Before that, though, the news roundup. And this top story just seems to be too radical for me to believe. Apple is using something called a human editor. What is that?
Is this news? Sure, they hired a bunch of journalists last year.
So just to really unpack this then. So the NYT is reporting that Apple is doing something radical in Silicon Valley. Instead of algorithms, it's letting humans pick the news. So it's got a dozen former journalists curating Apple News.
Yeah, see that? But that's the worst bit about this whole story.
Former journalists?
That's the NYT disappearing up its own attitude.
Yeah,
why are they former journalists?
Well, I think
one of the best tweets I saw on this was like, "Woohoo, Apple, you invented journalism."
Yeah, but I mean, it's a snippy response. It's unnecessarily snippy.
Yeah,
they are
actually that's true. Even that's snippy and it's bollocks.
Yeah. So there's nothing new under the sun, and you know, using human editors and human editorial judgment is great. You know, we've seen that there's, you know, enormous harm that can come from algorithmically generated news feeds. So this part of the story.
Well, there's also harm that can come from human editors. The Tao Center did a study earlier this year, actually exactly on the editors at Apple News, and said that they actually end up falling into the trap of just preferring a few major newsrooms. So there are problems with human editors as well. And to sort of say that, oh, aren't Apple amazing? You know, they've got these human editors. It's like, well, great, but kind of, you know, is that how transparent is that process?
You're never going to have complete transparency when it comes to, you know, people or algorithms exercising editorial judgment. So does this then mean this is the death of algorithms?
No.
Okay. Why?
Because algorithms are cheap. Apple's not saying any of this. This is a story that the New York Times has done because they've interviewed this lady, Lauren Kern, who sounds great. She sounds like she's doing a good job. She's taking it seriously. She's getting on with it. And the New York Times has done this sniffy thing about former journalists and, oh my God, who knew? These radical Silicon Valley guys. Silicon Valley's not saying anything about this. They're just trying to, they've tried to create this story. And no, it's not the death of algorithms, because algorithms are useful. They're just, if they get out of control, they get insane.
So last week, you know, Klaus said that their approach is kind of human-led algorithms, where they've got the algorithms, but there are constant human checks. Humans kind of guide them. And that, to me, sounds like a more sensible approach. But to me, I don't think the issue here is how Apple are curating this. You know, great, the stories are getting a million visits, all over, fantastic. The money is not getting back to publishers, and that is where the problem is here.
But actually, that's not the problem. The problem is it won't amount to anything for Apple, and Apple will get bored, just as it did with the newsstand and digital magazines, and they'll move on to someone else, and they'll get, you know, it'll just fall by the wayside. They won't spend the time or the money on it. That's the problem.
Do you think that people, and this is a bit of a broader philosophical question, isn't it depressing that we are looking elsewhere? We are looking outside of journalism for journalism's savior. You know, every time a new platform appears, every time, you know, a new magazine bundle appears, people always ask, is this going to save journalism? And it's always coming from an outside source.
Oh, that's a big, we could do a special on that.
It struck me then, I was thinking about, you know, the times that people have said, will Facebook be the savior of journalism? Will Google's new drive to push subscriptions be the savior of journalism?
But I think that's more an indication that people don't really know where this is going. It's not their fault. It's the fault of, or not the fault, it's just the nature of the beast that this is developing so fast and in ways that people don't really understand yet, that Of course they're looking at it and they're thinking, oh, this will fix my problems. Oh, this will fix my problems. It's that grass is always greener thing.
Yeah. I think it goes back to what Lucy Kung was saying the other week when we interviewed her. You know, she's saying that everyone looks to Silicon Valley because there's this perception that they can make things work and that they are radical enough to provide that way forward, that path.
I think this is the thing. There's not going to be one big savior. It's going to be lots of little things that come together. It's like we've said so many times, there's no silver bullet. There's no one thing that's going to magically bring the money in. And I, you know, you can do a little bit on platforms. You can do a little bit with your own stuff. But you've got to have it at a core. You've got to have that reliance on yourself and your own site, your own audience. Everything else is a bonus.
Yeah.
If you that's can't... it in a nutshell.
After that slightly philosophical digression then, while Apple is using human editors, Wiki Tribune is actually letting some of its humans go. So this is the community-focused journalism site that was founded by Jimmy Wales, and it's laying off 12 of its editorial staff. And the kind of I asked for an interview a couple of weeks ago, and they said, well, can you check back in a few weeks? And I suppose this is why. And it's honestly, it seemed like a really, really, really good idea. I don't know how much either of you saw of it, but it, to me, it seemed to solve that trust problem that people have. You know, ironically, people do not trust Wikipedia necessarily, but when you show your workings out, that is one of the ways to solve that trust crisis.
Just reading between the lines, one of the problems seems to be that the humans were too much to the fore, and the contributors weren't actually leading the content the way that it had originally been thought about.
Mm.
So now they seem to be refocusing on the Wikipedia model, which is kind of community editors and community contributors. I think they're talking about bringing editors or journalists back in the future, but they'll be more in a kind of collaboration type role rather than a leadership type role. I'd love to know why Peter Bale left, to be honest. I know he sometimes we've seen his name listening to this.
Mm.
And if Peter, if you're listening, come on and tell us why you left Wiki Tribune. Actually, come on and tell us what you're doing now. Never mind Wiki Tribune.
I love the idea that we just solicit our potential listeners to come on and talk. That's great. So what do you think then? Is going forward then, can that community verification aspect of it, can that work for news in the same way that it has kind of online encyclopedias?
I hate to be really boring, but The Correspondent.
Oh, God. Okay, it has been 0 days since we made a The Correspondent reference.
I'm sorry, but that's what they do. They're, you know, the community is their Rolodex.
Well, moving on then, Refinery29, who is somebody else who we've actually had on the podcast, is laying off 10% of its workforce as it falls short of revenue targets. Esther, what happened with this one?
This one's interesting because as soon as you hear, you know, publishers laying off its workforce, you think, oh gosh, you know, that's 10 more editorial staff out in the wild. I think it's 40 people they're cutting here. Actually, where they're cutting is really interesting. So most of the cuts are coming from product, engineering, and video. And part of this is because they're really pulling back on social media. They're looking to produce half the amount of content. And one of my favorite quotes was, while this type of content has been driving views, it's not yielded a great monetization strategy to justify the same level of continued investment. So, like, that's exactly what you should be doing. It's not bringing in the revenue. Cut back on it. And, you know, it's obviously sad people lost their jobs, but in a way it was relief not to be another bunch of editorial people.
Yep. I just, you know, there is a bit of cynicism out there on the other side of this. You know, the idea that they're making these cuts just ahead of the point that they're going to have to report on their targets and... I mean, I'm assuming Refinery29 is VC funded, and that's the reason that, you know, people saying, oh, we're cutting back just in time to keep the VCs happy. So I don't know.
Interesting that you talk about VC funding there when we've actually got a quote from Rafa Ali in this section.
You know, he said this on Twitter that he said just in time to pass it off as targets missing cuts like they did last year. So. And he's very cynical about the whole VC situation.
Esther, we're playing armchair CEO now. You're in control of Refinery29. What do you do now? Where do you invest?
In the editorial team and the audience.
Yay! Boom!
I would always go editorial team and audience. And possibly, I think, content partnerships are a place that Refinery29 has done very well in and is well positioned to carry on well in. So strengthen your audience, strengthen your content partnerships.
I think the other thing
that Rafa said was that anyone that tries to be Condé Nast is kind of screwed. And in that sense, I'm probably putting words in his mouth here, but that idea of don't try and be someone else, try and do your own thing, build your own audience, do your own content, your own angles.
Yeah. Understand who you are and what you want to be. Hey, speaking of, Twitter has been profitable since the fourth quarter of 2017. So it's actually just reported.
Shut the front.
I know, it's actually just reported its fourth consecutive quarter of profit. So it made profit of $1 billion since the fourth quarter of 2017. We're going to post the chart on the newsletter. This is fantastic news for Twitter, because if you think about the previous podcast that we've done, even a year ago, we were talking about, how do you save Twitter? How do you make Twitter profitable? What the hell do we do when Twitter goes down? Inevitably goes down. And now this has been a sort of reversal of fortune based on, you know, what Bruce Dacey told us, it being a platform for news and for really improving the quality of its audience.
I'm feeling grumpy today, and I'm going to have a grumpy gripe about this. This is already great, so I'm really, really happy for Twitter. I think they absolutely deserve this. The number of people that were posting stories like, Twitter's lost 9 million users, including Donald Trump, by the way. It's like Twitter has made inroads. It's not solved the problem, but it's made real inroads into getting rid of a lot of the bot problems, trying to tackle the bot networks. Yes, Twitter's lost 9 million users, but if they were all bots, then Twitter has fundamentally understood that to get money, you need actual people, and to grow, you need actual people. It's quality, not quantity.
Well, I think you're on fire this week, Esther. You need to do this more often, hungover. I mean, the one thing Jack Dorsey said, he's like made this comment about context and conversations, and he wants ad targeting to be better, so you get more relevant ads. And I think that's true. And I also saw someone saying that they were getting too many ads recently. So I think it's got a way to go. But yeah, the fact that it's profitable, absolutely. Great. Great news.
If Twitter want to nail ad targeting, they need to do what no other platform has yet actually done. Ask people what they want to see.
Edit button.
All of the platforms have options where you can go and see, and you can see what, like, you know, you can go into Facebook, you can go into Twitter, you can see what they think they've figured out about you. But there's no way to be like, actually, do you know what? I love musical theatre. I don't interact with it on Twitter because I kind of try not to scare people off. But I might actually want to see an ad about a ticket deal for Hamilton, even though you don't know that about me. Let me tell you.
So we're now able to offer transcriptions of our interviews thanks to our partnership with Trint, who have a clever AI automated transcription tool for audio and video. Look out for more details both about them and the transcripts in our weekly newsletter, or get in touch with us if you'd like to be added to the exclusive email list to receive the transcriptions as soon as they go live on a Monday.
So this week I spoke to Claire Sanderson. She's the Editor-in-Chief of Women's Health. And I started by asking her what her day-to-day role involved and why they're defying circulation trends in women's magazines.
So I'm the editor on a day-to-day basis of the magazine, but my job is far more reaching, wide-reaching than that. So I'm across the whole brand. So I get involved in events, in product licensing, and also my team in the UK are the primary content provider for women's health editions all over the world. So how it works is we're a global network of women's health. So I think we're in 33 countries at the last count. And all the editors can share content, and our content goes up on a content management system so they can download what they want. And 80% of the content downloaded globally is prepared by my team in the UK.
That's quite a bit. And Women's Health is one of the few traditional women's sort of lifestyle brands that's bucking the trends in declining circulation, certainly in the UK. What do you think are some of the key reasons for this?
I think the primary reason is wellness. And I think wellness is on a trajectory that very few people could have predicted, and it is showing no sign of abating. To put this into context, I spoke at the Global Wellness Summit in Italy last weekend.
In fact, there is a Global Wellness Summit.
Exactly. And it's in its 11th year or something. And they had researchers there saying that the wellness industry is worth $4.2 trillion. That's incredible. And in the UK, wellness is now social currency. You know, when I was in my 20s, social currency came from which nightclub you went to. Now it's which boutique gym you're working out at. And especially millennials, they're drinking less. And it's all about how well you are and how strong you look and how fit you are. So that's the primary reason for Women's Health success. And then secondly, it's our content, which I think is incredible content. It's science-backed, it's well-researched, and we give people information that could be seen as quite dry. A lot comes from research papers from world-leading universities, but we present it in such a way that it's digestible and interesting, the type of information that you want to share with your friends. And I think our tone is funny. We have an irreverent tone. I think we're a very cool-looking magazine. We get the best cover stars. I've got an amazing creative team that make it look really cool and funky. And I think that sets us apart from other wellness publications as well. So we're almost like, well, we're not almost, we are a monthly glossy. And we're as cool as a monthly glossy, but we're presenting wellness, which is the zeitgeisty thing everyone's into at the moment.
But with a factual backing, unlike some other wellness magazines we can probably think of.
It's absolutely fact-based. So every piece of content is thoroughly researched and science-backed. And now I've told you that, if you were to pick up Women's Health, you would see how many research papers we refer to, or the world-leading experts that we use. And everyone, when we pick up the phone and say we're from Women's Health UK, everyone wants to speak to us because we are the leading wellness brand. So we speak to leading neuroscientists, top nutritionists, top doctors, top physios, the best trainers in the world. If we pick up the phone and say, well, for instance, my Jan Feb cover, who I'm not going to tell you who that is because it's not coming out, but it's probably the biggest fitness star in the world, and she paid for herself to fly from another continent to London for us to shoot her for the cover. She was, because we, you know, editorial budgets are not so extensive that we can pay for someone on their team to fly over, but she was that keen for us to shoot her, and that just goes to show the power that Women's Health UK has.
And the magazine, in the print magazine, has also increased its revenue for the sixth consecutive year, I think I read, which again is quite unusual for the magazine sector. So is this down to sort of diversification, or has there been a growth in ad revenue for the title?
It's largely down to circulation growth, because we've posted a 12th consecutive growth in ABC circulation figures. So we launched 6 years ago, and we've grown ever since. You know, we've never dropped. So. And, you know, we sell for £4.20 on the newsstand. So more than half of our revenue is circulation growth. But then it is a growth in digital advertising, for instance, because we've got a phenomenally successful digital proposition, both through social media and our website, and diversification within the brand. So we've got a really successful fit kit range at Argos. We, you know, there's plans to bring out other licensed products, and we held several really successful events last year. So anything that with the Women's Health brand people want to engage with, we have a very engaged audience, so they are buying our products and they do come to our events.
How do you plan to continue the audience and revenue growth, given that the wellness trend is such a kind of hot topic at the moment?
Well, I plan to keep on growing circulation. events, experiential. Women really want to engage with Women's Health at every touch point, but I would say the primary touch point is events, because wellness lends itself to experiential, doesn't it? If you come along and you work out with your favourite trainers. So next year we are launching a big wellness event. More details, TBC, but it's going to be much bigger than anything we've done before. And then we will do a smattering of smaller events throughout the year as well, so people feel they can continue engaging with us.
You've been involved yourself in launching a couple of events that have kind of connected directly with readers. Can you tell us about some of them and why you decided to launch them?
Well, we did Fit Night Out last year, which was
fun.
It was fun. And the reason why we chose to do it is that we wanted to tap into this whole thing that women are socialising through exercise. So it's very normal now for a group of girlfriends to get together and go to a boutique gym and do a class, and then go for a glass of Prosecco after, or even go for a protein shake in the cafe attached to that gym. So what we wanted to turn, it was like a fitness, but as a night out. So we took over Victoria House in Holborn, and 500 readers come along. We sold our tickets very quickly, and it was a really lovely event. We had three workout rooms, so there was classes going on simultaneously, and the way it worked was, if you did, say, the 6 o'clock class in that room, then you can go into the 7 o'clock one in the next room. And we had some really big trainers there. We had Boys of Yoga, Alice Living, just really the cool London brands. And then we also had panel talks, which I hosted, and we got some quite big names for our audience. So, for instance, Gemma Atkinson was one on one of the panels. panels. Well, she was on Strictly at the time. So Louise Thompson was on one of the panels. She was our best-selling cover from last year. Our July issue last year was the best-selling issue of the whole year. So she's really big for our audience. And also people like Alice Living, who is a big fitness influencer, a huge following in the fitness world. She is as famous as a soap actress. You know, people were queuing up to take pictures with her. They weren't interested with me. They wanted to speak to Alice. I said, okay, I can take it. So it was a really fun evening. And then we had braid bars there and some nice food, Detox Kitchen doing food. And we had Pip and Nut making smoothies. So it was a really lovely evening. And it was a good springboard and learnings to take on to our event next year, which is going to be on a much bigger scale. And it'll be over several days as opposed to several hours.
You became editor-in-chief last year. What are some of your key achievements since you've become editor-in-chief?
I think In Shape My Shape last year was a big achievement. In Shape My Shape is a campaign that we launched in our July issue, and it was all based around body confidence and general confidence. And what we did, we gave away slogan cards in the magazine. We printed them on cards. There was better quality than just the normal paper that you could on perforated, so you could tear out. And there was four slogans in the mag, and then we also put another four slogans online. And we launched it by asking influencers and celebrities who resonated with the brand to take pictures of themselves with these cards. And there were slogans like, I love the shape I'm in, that, you know, I don't exercise for likes and stuff like that. And we asked them to share them on their social media channels when the mag was on sale. And then we also asked our readers to do the same. And we couldn't have predicted how popular it was going to be. And in the first year alone, its reach on social media, just from the top 20 celebrities and influencers who took part, its reach was 49 million, which is incredible. And this year we did it again, and it was about 52 million this year. So in 2 years, that campaign has had over 100 million reach on social media, which is crazy. And it just, I think we tapped into the movement towards body acceptance, body positivity. There's a new phrase called body neutrality now, which is when you may not feel that you can be completely positive about your body, but you're neutral, you're accepting of it, and it works for you. And I think we tapped into that. And even after this year, we did it again in July this year, and we're now in October, and I still see people sharing the slogan cards. So it really resonates, and I don't know whether they're just suddenly finding them, like they come across a mag in the dentist or something, you know, or they've still got them in their bedroom and it's still resonating, but people are still sharing them. And another one of my achievements is how I'm opening up the dialogue around mental health. I've got mental health issues. I'm very open about them. I've been in hospital twice for, you know, a total of 11 weeks. So it's not tokenism. I've been there, and I know how appallingly bad it can be when you've got depression. So when I joined Women's Health, I decided that we should have a mind issue. And we decided that the way to really bring this issue to life and make an impact on our readers was to get successful women to talk about their mental health problems, because women empathize with other women. And when we see women who inspire us saying, this happened to me, this is how I dealt with it, if it's happening to you, there is hope, it really resonates. So last year we got 23 women doing it, and they were all at the top of their game. So there was a CEO, there was several CEOs, in fact, authors, a serving MP, a pop star. And as we were planning the feature, I thought, well, I'm a complete hypocrite if I don't talk about my own experience. Like, how can I ask these women to put themselves out there and talk about it if I'm not willing to do the same? And it took a lot of soul searching to decide whether I was going to talk about it, because up until that point, I'd been quite secretive about it, because this happened when I was 27, I'm now 40. And I've been quite secretive, and I've worked in magazines since and never really mentioned it. I thought it's my business, it's private. And also I was probably a little bit guilty of the whole stigmatism around mental health is seen as a weakness and all that nonsense, really. So I decided last year that I was going to talk about it, and it really made a difference, I think. I had so many messages from women on social media and in person, in fact, or on my work email, saying that I'd inspired them and how wonderful it was to see someone in my position who is successful but has overcome such difficulties in their mental health. And I basically, now I've started talking about it, it's almost like I can't shut up, because because I often get asked to talk about it now, which is what my PR team told me would happen last year. Because when I sought advice from them and said, should I talk about this? And they said, think carefully, because it will follow you around and you will be the editor of Women's Health who has mental health issues. But actually, it's quite wonderful that I am being asked to speak regularly on quite big stages in front of a lot of people talking about it. So this year again, our mind issue's on sale at the moment, actually. And it's to link in with World Mental Health Day. And although I didn't take part in the feature this year, I spoke about it in my Ed's letter. And again, like even before you arrived, somebody poked their head in and said, loved your editor's letter. It seems to resonate with people, and they feel comforted that it's not just them, it's happening to other people. I spoke about it at the Global Wellness Summit this weekend, and four women come up to me crying at the end with tears in their eyes. And one woman I'd actually got quite friendly with, and then she came up to me and she had tears in her eyes and she was shaking and she put her arm around me. She said, it happened to me. I've had 2 years of hell. It happened to me. And all she wanted was to tell me that it was happening to her. And I think people want to open up and they need to be given permission to open up. And I don't think people got that permission until they see other people doing it. So if I can get people talking more about mental health issues, and there's research shown that if you talk about it, you're on the road to recovery. And one of the reasons why the ever so sad stats of male suicide are alarmingly so high. 1 in 12 men, according to Calm, commit suicide, is because men are much less likely to open up. They're much less likely to speak to their friends or speak to their loved ones, whereas women are, and I want to enforce that. So I would say one of my achievements definitely is opening and leading the conversation within women's media on mental health. And I would just like to say other magazines are now doing the same, and that's brilliant. I don't feel like they're stepping on my toes, but I would like to think that we were instrumental in starting that.
I suppose it's part of it is that perception that actually health is not just physical.
Yeah.
There's a lot more kind of going on.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. It's holistic. And I think that is generally how wellness is going at the moment. Whereas even 2-3 years ago, wellness, people really thought that was eating less calories and going to the gym to get abs and biceps. You know, it was all quite aesthetic, but people are definitely realising that it is holistic, and it's actually what you nourish your body with, both with food and meditation and yoga and exercise, has such an effect on everything, and how you sleep and how you perform in work and your mental health. And there are gyms in London, now Equinox is one of them, that are advertising classes on the effect it will have on your mental health, not your physical health. So that's definitely the way it's going, and I can't be more pleased that that's happening.
And would you say things like social media are kind of, they compound those problems a lot more, or has it opened up the conversation around mental health?
I think it's opened up the conversation about mental health, because I think high profile influencers are talking about their mental health. And as I've just said, I think people find comfort in other people talking about it. And social media is just another example of media, and the media has been criticised for how many years for, you know, encouraging eating disorders and all sorts of, and actually eating disorders is a really complicated mental health issue. You know, there's so much going on there, and it's not a one thing they've been influenced by. That's a much more complicated condition. So I actually think social media is opening up the conversation, and it's offering a community to people who sometimes might not have someone they can speak to, or anyone that they know is going through that situation.
Are there any other steps you take to try and keep the brand kind of relevant and up to date, given that on social media there's been this huge rise of wellness influencers, fitness?
Influencers are brilliant. Influencers really sell on my cover. So, one of the, you know, the biggest selling issues for us have been influencers. And one of the reasons for that is we are a really powerful brand. We are so big, we're all encompassing. So influencers really want to be on our cover, because it is seen as the highest achievement you can have in wellness to be on the cover of Women's Health. So
to be on the cover of a print magazine.
Yes, absolutely. And it's like a mini poster and it's tangible and you can touch it. And it's on sale in 300,000 retailers in the UK. And I've just made that number up, but I'm assuming it's about that. So what these influencers do, once we put them on the cover, they're so pleased, they go on One Women PR campaigns to promote us. So it is impossible to quantify the amount of PR we get from these influencers who are putting us on their social channels to their highly engaged, borderline fanatical audiences. So I love influencers, they're brilliant. So, and that's one of the ways that we are keeping the mag relevant, is that I am very much embracing that world into the brand, both in print and events. So for instance, we have a monthly column with Alice Living. She's a massive fan of the brand. I would say she's an ambassador of the brand. And then she promotes us on her channels. So it's all of us win. You know, she gets to say that she's in Women's Health, and then we get her audience, some of which who might be quite young and not natural magazine readers, and she brings us onto the brand. And one of the reasons we are growing is that wellness is non-age specific. So we are bringing in the younger readers. Plus, we're getting the older readers, by the way, because women in their, I'm 40, I train all the time, you know, women in their 50s are doing CrossFit and above. So that's one of the reasons we're growing, is that we can bring in some of that audience that may more naturally lean towards digital. Plus we're bringing those older ones who just want to look and feel amazing.
Are there any challenges the brand has around sort of translating into the digital space?
We're doing it really well. The digital team and the print team work as one. We work very closely together and we look at content from a very 360 basis. So in its most simplistic form, we shot our Jan-Feb cover last week with a big influencer, and the digital team shot loads of video content to go with it. And then we will do like little Instagram snippet stories with her, like, you know, the top five things I do every morning or something. So we very much complement each other. We drive audiences between both of our platforms. So I embrace digital. You know, our digital audience is growing much like our print audience is growing, and that can't be a coincidence because we work really closely together.
And are there any developments in technology and media that you're really excited about with regards to the future of Women's Health?
Yeah, VR. VR is going to be the future of wellness. It's already happening a bit now. You know, Peloton has come to the UK. Peloton is this spin bike that you can buy, and it's huge in America. But what you do is you can buy the spin bike and have it in your home, but then you can link up to these live spin classes where people all over the world are doing. So it's like you've got your headphones on, it's like you're in a spin class in LA, but actually you're sat in Bradford or something, you know. So, and I think virtual reality fitness is absolutely the future. I went to Techno Gym headquarters for the Global Wellness Summit, which I mentioned. The tech in their gym was incredible. Like, I was like a kid in a sweet shop, you know. They were doing fairly predictable classes, like, you know, a circuit class, which they call skills athletic and rowing and spinning. But the tech involved made it much more experiential. So, you know, I'm a rower. I used to be a competitive rower. I love rowing. So I was sitting on the rowing machine, but it was like I was on water competing with the people next to me. It was just brilliant. And the spin class that they were running, they had a screen in front of them. And it wasn't just a token TV screen, you know, the size of a normal TV. It was a whole wall. And it's like you're in the French Alps competing with each other. I mean, it was really, really incredible. And what I'm also seeing is, whereas, say, 5 years ago, the type of tests athletes would require, now social exercisers want. And by that, I mean, people are much more educated, so they want their VO2 max tests, they want their gene tests, they want all these, you know, so the type of test that you would see at a sports lab for professionals, now just social exercisers want. So you're going to see more and more of it around gyms in London, and then it will then it'll go out. It started with the Apple Watch Series 4. That there's so much you can test. You can test your VO2 max on this Apple Watch, apparently. But I think there's a lot of technology coming in where people want information about their wellness because people are so engaged with their wellness at the moment.
And one of the questions we always ask our guests is, what's the last thing you saw or read that really affected you?
I read a mental wellness white paper when I was at the Global Wellness Summit, and it said that more money is spent in the UK on disposable coffee than it is on mental health care for the country. Like, so we as a nation spend more money on a monthly basis just buying coffee from various coffee outlets than what is being spent on looking after our mental health. And I think that's shocking. So even though we're in this little bubble of London at the moment where we are talking about mental health and we are, you know, looking after our mental health by physically moving and stuff, we've got a long way to go for that message to get out of London, and also for the government to realise and invest more money into mental health care, especially amongst young people. And there's a growing rise of mental health issues, especially among young girls. But if you report to your GP, you're told you've got to wait God knows how long to see a therapist or get any sort of help to put strategies in place. And by that point, it might be too late.
So if you've been living under a rock for the last year, we have a newsletter. Got loads of stuff in there. What we're reading, insights into this week's interview. We've got links now to our transcripts. You can read the whole interview if you don't want to listen. Don't know why you wouldn't want to listen, but there you go. And also links to the news that we discussed, and also all the news stories that we mentioned maybe but didn't get into discussion. The links will be there so you can go and find out more for yourself. Sign up at our website or follow the Twitter profile.
Talking of Twitter, we're definitely worth following there at Media Voices Pod. Everything we've discussed is posted on there as soon as we find it. And then there's loads more kind of news, opinion each week.
But until next week, when we're going to be back with another fantastic guest. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.